Hello and welcome to Nanotech Review. My name is Stuart Cameron. No doubt many of you have heard about the impending nanotechnology revolution. In this podcast, we will attempt to explain some of the science, technology, social and ethical issues that underlie recent developments in nanotechnology. Following a short introduction to the subject, I'll be interviewing some key players in nanotechnology to understand their technology, where this technology will make an impact, and the issues that shape their business or research, from the technological barriers they encounter through to social and ethical concerns. I should say at the outset that the team at azonano.com who've produced this podcast are grateful for the financial contribution and staff support received from Nanotechnology Victoria. Based in Melbourne, Australia, NanoVic and its chief executive, Dr. Peter Binks, are leading the efforts of the Australian nanotech community by bringing together scientists, academics, nanotech entrepreneurs, whilst engaging the wider community in topical nanotech issues. So what is nanotechnology and where did the revolution start? Let's deal first of all with the dry scientific definition of nanotechnology. It is commonly recognized as the science that involves individual atoms, molecules, and structures that range in size from 1 to 100 nanometers, or in scientific terms, that's 10 to the minus 9. Many of you may find those hard scientific facts hard to relate to the real world that surrounds us. So let's start our journey down in size with the average 8-year-old at around 1 meter tall. That's 10 to the 0 meters. A fly is approximately 1 centimetre, that's 10 to the minus 2 metres or 0.01 metres. Hopefully you can now start to see the relationship between the 10 to the minus statement and the number of zeros after the decimal point. As we go down in size, we hit the limit of our eyesight to resolve small objects at around 10,000 nanometres. Red blood cells are around 5,000 nanometres in diameter and E. coli bacteria are 2,000 nanometres across. We know we've entered the nano world when we start to deal with the key components on a transistor, which are now in the region of 90 nanometers. The ubiquitous cold virus is 50 nanometers, and our DNA is 2 nanometers. Finally, one could say we hit the bottom when we start to work on the hydrogen atom at 10 to the minus 10, or 0.1 nanometers. So now the sizing thing is out of the way, we should ask when nanotechnology came about. As with many revolutions, it's often difficult to pinpoint the exact start date, but many commentators refer to a lecture to the annual meeting of the American Physical Society in December 1959, given by Richard Feynman, titled There's Plenty of Room at the Bottom. Feynman's lecture, which is a great read and is freely available on the web, sets the scene for what could be done by greater miniaturization and where the technology could lead us. Unfortunately for him, Feynman's vision was constrained by the ability of scientists to inspect atoms and molecules at the nano level. But if we skip forward to the 1980s, the invention of the scanning tunneling microscope and the atomic force microscope then allowed scientists to investigate surfaces and structures at the atomic level. These microscopic tools were like the picks and shovels of the nanotech gold rush. In parallel with the developments in microscopy, 1986 also saw the publications of Engines of Creation by Eric Drexler. This book set the scene for the potential of molecular self-assembly or bottom-up nanotechnology. Throughout history, manufacturing operations have focused on machining materials to the required shape and size. Such machining processes, which can produce very small devices such as transistors, are described as top-down processes. Drexler's book, on the other hand, brought into the public consciousness what could be achieved by the production of devices from molecules that could be encouraged to self-assemble and replicate. Although pilloried by large sections of the scientific establishment for his views being unrealistic and unworkable, some of his ideas have gained credence and the potential for assembling structures from the bottom up is no longer science fiction. Drexler's book also raised the issue of the grey goo, the nightmare vision of what could occur if self-assembling nano-replicators got out of control. Not surprisingly, this aspect of what we'll call nano-science fiction had a great impact on the popular press, led to health-related comments from Prince Charles and the scientifically inaccurate but big-selling novel Prey by Michael Crichton. The 90s saw further developments in nanotechnology and the fabrication of genuine nanomaterials. In 1996, scientists Richard Smalley, Robert Curl Jr. and Sir Harold Kroto were awarded the Nobel Prize for Physics for their work 10 years earlier in producing a very small 1 nanometer diameter soccer ball from 60 carbon atoms. The arrangement of the carbon atoms was very similar to a dome design for the 1967 Montreal World Exhibition by architect R. Buckminster Fuller, and led to the carbon atom soccer ball being designated as a Buckminster Fullerene, or as it's often known these days, as a buckyball. Governments around the world then began to pick up on the potential for nanotechnology to significantly impact on all walks of life. A very big rubber stamp was placed on this fledgling technology in January 2000, when President Bill Clinton mentioned nanotechnology in his State of the Union address, and in October 2000, the US National Nanotechnology Initiative, or NNI, was announced with a $500 million budget. In 2002, United States Senator Ron Wyden introduced a bill that created a new permanent federal agency to provide a smart, accelerated, and organized approach to nanotechnology, research, development, and education. Wyden, as chairman of the Subcommittee on Science, Technology, and Space, stated that nanotechnology has the potential to change America on a scale equal to, if not greater than, the computer revolution. To do that, he said, the country must marshal its various nanotechnology efforts into one driving force to remain the world's leader in this burgeoning field. Now in its fifth year, the NNI now coordinates a budget of nearly $1 billion across 21 federal agencies and departments. Perhaps historians will view the noughties as the decade when nanotech really arrived. So that's a very short potted history of nanotech. But where is it heading and what are the practical applications? A recent research report from the Nomura Research Institute in Japan, which forecasts the growth of the Japanese nanotechnology product market through to 2015, details 8 key product sectors where nanotech will drive the current market from 942 billion yen in 2004 through to 23,000 billion yen in 2015. Just so we're clear on the numbers, that's $8 billion growing to almost $200 billion, a forecast market growth factor of 25 times in less than 10 years. The product sectors identified by the Nomura Institute where nanotech will either develop new markets or lead to a replacement of existing markets include consumer products such as cosmetics and sporting goods, automotive applications, industrial robots, dental, orthopedic and medical products, electronic devices such as integrated circuits and magnetic memory, energy-related products such as fuel cells, solar cells and batteries, as well as new and improved materials and associated measuring or inspection devices. There's obviously a lot to cover when one talks of the application of nanotech, and we could easily fill a 5-hour podcast just discussing those. But for now, let's hear from some key players and listen to their views. Cyveda Limited is a global bio-nanotech company listed on the NASDAQ, Australian and Frankfurt stock exchanges. Cyveda's core product, called biosilicon, is a revolutionary material that can deliver and release drugs into the human body in a very controlled fashion. Biosilicon's unique properties result from its nanostructure. Biosilicon is one of the most exciting nanotechnology products being developed in Australia. I spoke with Gavin Rezos about biosilicon. Gavin Rezos, as the former CEO and a board-level consultant to Cyveda, a nanotech company that's at the forefront of nanomaterials and healthcare, can you set the scene for us and describe the major application of Cyveda's biosilicon nanomaterial and provide some background on the nanotechnology that underpins this general technology?
Yes, Stuart, certainly. Biosilicon is effectively silicon which is in everyday use around the world. But we nanostructure it, that is, we fill it full of holes at the atomic level. And by doing that, it enables the material to dissolve in the body. Ordinary silicon won't dissolve at all, but at the atomic level, we massively increase the surface area by the nanostructuring process, so much so that a saucer-shaped piece of silicon, when it's nanostructured, would have the same surface area as a football field. Now, by doing that, there's a lot more exposure of the material in the body, and it allows the silicon to dissolve into silicic acid, which is a natural form of silicon used in the body as a trace element. So the starting material is generally regarded as safe. The byproduct, silicic acid, is regarded as safe. but is used essentially in the body for drug delivery purposes, as well as for diagnostics. And there's a separate subsidiary of Cyveda called Aon Diagnostics, which uses the material for imaging applications.
How is biosilicon actually fabricated? I mean, once it got out of the laboratories and was commercialized, how do you go about that process?
Well, we use consultants and contractors for that effectively. So in the UK, Hyforth take the material for the one application, which is in liver and pancreatic cancer. They jet mill granules, micron-sized granules of silicon, so it's all the same size. And then through different acid processes, there's two or three different ways we can do that, whether it's by hydrofluoric acid bath or stain etching processes. That's how you create the holes in the material.
I believe Cyveda have also been involved with products for liver cancer and diabetic macular edema. Can you shed some light on these particular products?
Yes, liver cancer is particularly aggressive. It's unfortunately one of the rising cancers in the world. The product we use for liver cancer is biosilicon, but we include within the biosilicon radionuclide P32 or phosphorus 32, which is a beta emitter, so it has a very, very small kill range, so it's not hurting any healthy tissue in the body. It's only impacting the tumor itself. It has an ideal half-life. It lasts 14 days in the body, the first half-life, progressively decays from there, and it's controllable. So that's a product in liver cancer. It's in phase 2 clinical trials, having passed phase 1 already, where it showed that there was no adverse side effects, it's safe, and that it has efficacy. In fact, some of the tumors were regressed by 100%. So that's in phase 2, and it's about to start a phase 1 trial in pancreatic cancer in the UK. And pancreatic cancer has an unmet need. There is nothing for pancreatic cancer at the moment, a 4% survival rate. That's biosilicon with the P32. Now, you can't take P32 systemically, of course. It's a difficult substance to handle. So by putting it into the biosilicon, that matrix safely holds it in the body and allows it to emit the radiation directly into the tumor. So you're not getting radiation to the whole body. Now, in terms of diabetic macular edema, we have a facility in Boston. In fact, they have the only two ever approved drug delivery devices for the back of the eye through the FDA. Vitrasert, which is some years ago, the next one approved was Retisert, which is for uveitis. But the next one along is Medidur, which is for diabetic macular edema. And Medidur is it's a micron size. In fact, it's a tiny little tube. But one or both ends can have a nano-structured membrane, which allows the drug to seep out, and the pressure inside the cylinder equalizes, but to seep out over 18 months to 3 years to release a steroid to combat diabetic macular edema. And that is currently going through phase 3 clinical trials in the US, India, UK, Canada. It's a very valuable product.
Gavin Rezos, thank you very much for your time today.
Pleasure, Stuart.
Continuing for now on the medical theme, let's hear from the CEO of a nanotech company which is active in dendrimer and nanotechnology for medical applications. Jackie Fairley is the CEO of Star Pharma, a company listed on the Australian Stock Exchange that is currently being supported by the US-based National Institute of Health to further develop their novel VivaGel. Jackie Fairley, can you provide us with a little background on your company, Star Pharma, and the products that the company is developing and producing?
Sure. Star Pharma is an ASX-listed biotechnology company focusing in the application of nanotechnology for pharmaceuticals. We're using a particular type of compound, and dendrimer, which is a relatively large synthetic macromolecule. But unlike many macromolecules, one which can be assembled in a very precise and reproducible manner, we're applying the first product that we're applying our dendrimer technology to is a product called VivaGel, which is a topical microbicide currently under development together with fairly substantial NIH financial support to prevent the transmission of HIV and genital herpes. So it's a gel product which incorporates this dendrimer product.
for much of the history of nanotechnology, there was talk about nanotech applications to material sciences. In the last few years, commentators have been talking about a revolution in nanotechnology applied to healthcare. Are we in the midst of a nanotechnology healthcare revolution?
I think we are, actually. And in fact, if you look at industry commentators about the importance of nanotechnology in life sciences going forward, certainly the Lux Research Group in the US have done such an analysis and are predicting that it will contribute very substantially to life sciences and pharmaceutical applications. I think by 2014, they're predicting that 16% of goods in healthcare and life sciences by revenue will be emerging nanotechnology products. So that's an important, that will be a very important component of the overall sector of healthcare and life sciences. And so I think we are maybe not in the midst of it. I think maybe more at the early stages of. VivaGel, our Star Pharma's lead product, is in fact the first Dendrima to have ever been submitted under an investigational new drug application to the FDA, and so is a sort of at a forefront, is a leader, I suppose, in terms of taking Dendrimas as drugs through a regulatory system. So I think there's, in time it will grow. I think we're at the beginning of that sort of upswing in the curve.
Do you see that there are certain hot areas for nanotech-related medical and healthcare products?
I think there are. I think that there are a number of companies working on looking at molecules like dendrimers and other nanotech agents, in particularly in the areas of cancer, infectious diseases, and also in terms of targeting and targeted diagnostics. I think all of those areas are particularly hot, and in fact, recently there was a publication about the attachment of certain types of cancer antibodies to a dendrima and using that as a means to target chemotherapeutics. I think we'll see breast tumours in this case, I think we'll see a lot more of that sort of targeted delivery going forward.
Dr. Jackie Fairley, thank you very much for your time today.
That's fine.
Moving on from healthcare, let's now dive into nanotech and water, with Dr. Sarah Morgan, the project manager for the novel biosensing technology being developed at Monash University's School of Applied Sciences and Engineering. Dr. Sarah Morgan, you're working in the field of nanotechnology as applied to biosensors and particularly water sensors. Can you provide some background on your nanotech research?
Oh, yes. The biosensor project is one that we're doing with Monash University Gippsland campus. The biosensor is a sensor that's going to be used in the laboratory, but more importantly within the field. It will be able to measure ions like phosphate and nitrate, which are most important in environmental waters in which you need to measure, say, for algal blooms before they begin. So you can actually take the biosensor out into the field. You can put the biosensor into the water, get a reading straight away rather than take your water back to the laboratory and wait a couple of days or whatever delay you have, and know there and then what the answer is and what the result is.
What are the practical applications of this biosensor once it is commercialised?
Once it is commercialised, it can be used for, say, water authorities that want to know what's in their rivers and streams. That's one example. Other examples are for industry, for those that are pumping out wastewater. They need to know what's in the water and be able to measure it. Or you can even have applications such as the hydroponics industry. They are adding nutrients to their water for the growing of their plants, for the growing of their vegetables, their tomatoes, their flowers. So they also do need to know accurate concentrations of what's being delivered to their plants. So the biosensor can then measure that for them.
How is the underlying nanotechnology allowing you to build this sort of device?
The nanotechnology allows for greater sensitivity and accuracy. So the sensitivity is how low we can measure. It's very important to be able to measure low concentrations because sometimes there's a threshold level which are at low concentrations. So you need to be able to measure right down at those levels to be able to see the problem before it becomes a bigger problem.
The development of nanotech and water also plays a major role in the day-to-day business of Dr. Terry Turney of CSIRO, the Commonwealth Scientific and Industrial Research Organisation of Australia. We caught up with him to discuss the role of a national research body in an Australian context. However, many of Terry's points resonate around the nanotech world and have implications for all countries or national research bodies with a nanotech program. How long has the CSIRO been active in the nanotechnology area?
Well, we were one of the first movers in nanotech, I think you'd find. Depending on how you define it again, but we had our first products actually out in the marketplace in 1991. These were some active packaging films, which were deliberately designed by control of nanostructure. And I guess we've been active ever since in this area. We're working in a wide range of disciplines, chemistry, physics, engineering, biology, and being able to combine those because we're such a large and diverse organisation has given us a competitive advantage.
CSIRO appear to be very active in nanomaterials-related technologies. Are there any particular aspects of nanotechnology that benefit from an Australian base, perhaps relating to the booming resources industry?
Yes, there is. I mean, if you think about Australia and what sort of drives the Australian economy, we've got pluses and minuses. We're very rich in mineral resources, energy. We have enormous land mass. But on the other hand, we also have the problems with water. Our economy is absolutely limited by the availability of water now. So nanotechnology has some advantages which are coming out of the resource base that we have, but it also has some major drivers related to some of our shortages, some of our, I guess if you want, geographic weaknesses around water. Australia has traditionally also done very well in medical devices. So we have a very strong biological base, you know, with our stem cell lines, with our IVF programs, and we're globally competitive in that area. Nanotech is playing a role in there. What it needs to do is it needs to concentrate now on our manufacturing base to try and bring that up to a globally competitive level. And I think that's where the future emphasis of nanotechnology is going to be, and our nanomaterials research is certainly focusing on that.
That was Dr. Terry Turney with some thoughts on nanotech from a national perspective. In our next segment, we turn to what many would describe as real nanotech and visit the nanotech world of Professor Frank Caruso from the University of Melbourne to hear how he assembles nano-sized layers of polymers that have some very interesting properties and applications in drug delivery. Frank Caruso, can you tell us a little bit about the area of nanotechnology research that you're currently active in?
The research that my group is currently exploring focuses on the assembly of polymers at interfaces in order to create advanced polymer delivery vehicles for applications in the general area of nanobiotechnology, for example, drug delivery and also immuno-based sensing and diagnostics.
The layer-by-layer process that you use appears to be particularly innovative. Do you see this being used in other areas of nanotechnology research?
Yes, the layer-by-layer process is versatile. It is a process that one can apply to a variety of different materials, whether largely independent of the shape and size of the material. And so over the years, it has found application in, for example, coatings for anti-corrosion applications, contact lenses as well to minimize protein adhesion or anti-fouling coatings, and more recently concerning the work that my group and several other groups around the world are focusing on, the engineering of colloidal systems for applications in, again, nanobiotechnology or even as micro-reactor systems for the chemical synthesis of different components in a confined system.
Tell us about the challenges that you face in the course of doing your particular research. Are the biggest challenges scientific? Are they process technology related? Are they ethical? Are they social? What's the biggest challenge that you face on a daily basis?
Yeah, the largest challenge, I would say, because we are primarily focused on the scientific side of the research, is how we control matter at the nanoscale, and how we can manipulate the properties of the materials that we work with in order to generate specific functionalities in those systems. And understanding that often involves numerous scientific challenges, all the way from designing a given molecule or polymer and how to assemble that, and then in some cases how to characterise that particular system and assess its functionality.
Professor Frank Caruso, thank you very much for your time today.
Thank you.
Finally, we turn to Dr. Kristen Alford, the Marketing Director of Nanovic, and ask how she goes about engaging the outside world of the general public, industry and academia with nanotechnology. You're involved with the marketing of Nanovic, and obviously one of the key responsibilities of Nanovic is to get the nanotech message across and bring together key players in and outside of the industry. How are you going about that process?
Well, in the UK, the Royal Society and the Royal Society of Engineers did a very extensive survey that looked at the success of introducing new technologies, and one of their findings was that there needed to be a high degree of public awareness to fully realise the benefits of nanotechnology. And I think that's, you know, that's something that we've taken on board at Nanovic. And so we basically look at three main areas: industry, academia, and the general public. So in terms of getting the nanotech message across to industry, it's really achieved through designing and commercialising useful projects and useful applications that can be profitable for industry and meet new markets. In terms of academia, it's really about showcasing the important and exciting research that they're doing, and we've been doing that by rewarding excellent researchers with Nanovic prizes for innovation in nanotechnology, and the latest round of those has just occurred. And there's an enormous amount of activity occurring in Victoria across a full range of disciplines, including medicine, materials, energy, a whole lot of really interesting things happening. And that's a really good way of highlighting the work that's going on, as well as getting those academics to be able to find out more about nanotechnology in general. I guess the third area, and one of the ones that I get mostly involved in, is general public information around nanotechnology. We are pretty consistent in making sure that we have new information going on our website all the time about various projects, and I'm very conscious about expressing that in a way that's easy to understand. And our biggest set of activities at the moment is really about our schools program. So we've got a variety of activities for primary schools and secondary schools, and the biggest one of that at the moment is helping a secondary school develop a specific nanotechnology curriculum, which helps not only just to explain some of the wonder of nanotechnology, but provide students with the real science that's needed to take this technology further.
What do you see as the opportunities and threats for nanotechnology in both the short and long-term future?
I don't know whether I've really thought about it in terms of the short and long-term future, but for me there's two main threats, and one is just a failure to meet the hype of what people are saying is possible with nanotechnology, either, you know, through not imagining what is possible or limiting ourselves, I suppose, in one way, or limiting the amount of infrastructure and resources that we put towards it. The other one is really about toxicity of nanoparticles. And it's not so much whether there is a high degree of risk associated with them or not, because I think once we know that, then we can put steps into place to deal with it. It's more, I guess, the threat of not really understanding what the toxicity is and having that unknown. I think that's a greater risk, because it's very hard then to act when you don't know. In terms of the opportunities, I think the thing that excites me the most is the advances that are being made with medical diagnostics and targeted treatments. Just the idea that you can act on something with such precision in terms of targeting a specific cancer cell or a pathogen at a very fine level with minimizing harm to the rest of the body, I think is very exciting. And the other one is there's lots of fun applications of nanotechnology. So, you know, whether it's heat-sensitive paints or fluorescent particles, or I think there's a lot of fun that can be had with it. Arthur C. Clarke said that any sufficiently advanced technology is indistinguishable from magic. And for me, I'm looking forward to some nano-enabled magic.
Fantastic. Kristen Alford, thank you very much for your time today.
Thank you too.
From the Plenty of Room at the Bottom lecture in 1959 to targeted drug delivery systems and novel devices for water purification in 2006, it's apparent that nanotechnology has come a long way from relatively rudimentary beginnings, and it's very much the case that the nanotechnology revolution is here and now. We hope this podcast has given you a sense of the impact nanotechnology is making in many different sectors, and you'll tune into forthcoming Azo Nano podcasts on nanotech subjects ranging from the regulatory issues and environmental concerns through to even more nanotech applications, and a review of the nanotech tools that underpin nanotech science. We very much welcome your feedback and comments, so please write to podcast@azonano.com. If you're interested in more detailed information on the topics raised, please visit www.nanovic.com.au and www.azonano.com. Until next time, goodbye from the team at Azo Nano. I'm Stuart Cameron.